We are going to talk about how each and every one of us can leave a legacy. You know, the worries and demands of daily life can make it hard to plan for things even a year or so in the future. When you couple that with a reluctance to think about our own demise and a sense that if we're not millionaires, that we don't have much to leave, there are a lot of us who have not taken the time to think about what legacy we might want to have. And hopefully we're going to change that a bit today. Attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is the founder of Gustafson-Gervasi Law Office, LLC. It's located in Madison, and the practice provides legal services in the area of estate planning and probate. Melinda graduated from the University of Wisconsin Law School and holds a bachelor's degree from UW-Madison and a master's of public administration from the University of Southern California. She's the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. And Melinda, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's such a great topic to talk about because I think all of us want to think that we're going to leave the world in a better place, you know, after because of us or maybe in some cases despite us. But, you know, we are also living in a really unique period when it comes to the transfer of wealth from one generation to another. What conditions are at play right now?
Well, as the baby boomers transition, which I think is a nicer way of thinking about it, between, I think it's 1998 and 2052, $42 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars will pass hands from one generation to the next. And in the book, I just raised the question, what might our world look like if 5 or 10% of that were left to a cause that we feel is important and would better our world?
Yeah, you're not talking about every person leaving all of their money, just a tiny fraction of each could make a huge difference.
Correct. A lot of people, I think, when they hear the word philanthropy or philanthropist, imagine, you know, gated estates and lawyers in pinstripe suits behind mahogany desks where they're leaving their entire vast fortune. And I think the stories of the book that are included profile the fact that you don't have to leave everything to make a difference. And you certainly don't have to have a seven-figure net worth to do so either. A little bit of planning can go a long way.
And for people who might have a fairly modest income during their lifetime, leaving something that will go into effect after they pass is actually a way for them to have a much larger impact than they're able to during their lifetime.
Correct. We don't know when the time is going to come or how many resources we're going to have, but you can write things that say, you know, when my time comes, from what's left, I'd like to leave, you know, X, Y, or Z.
We are talking about leaving a legacy, and we'd like to hear from you, listeners. Have you thought about what kind of legacy you'd like to leave? Do you think maybe you don't have enough to leave a legacy? I think Melinda will be happy to show you ways that you can, and maybe you have already taken steps to provide for causes and nonprofit organizations that you care about. We'd love to hear about that when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melinda, you say in the introduction to your book, which is Middle Class Philanthropist, that you say, it is my belief that no matter the size of your wallet, anyone can leave a legacy. And maybe we should start out by talking about what do you mean by a legacy?
I think something that will nourish or promote things that are important to you. It might be helping to create the seed money at a church or a school or something that's important to you that will spur others to donate, something that will continue to grow after you're gone. I think that's one of the reasons I elected to put a picture of a tree on the cover, is that what starts as a simple sapling can grow and grow and grow and nurture and provide for decades to come.
And I really like the idea that you talked about people being an example, because I think often as I said, we get caught up in everyday things, but, you know, we do notice when someone making a very large gift who, you know, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, almost wiping out polio in India, things like that, you know, we focus on those things. But then, you know, when you look closer to home, there are probably people in our families or maybe in our faith communities where you just know that they are very charitably minded. And it's because they have been willing to be public in the sense of saying, look, you know, this is important to us. And so we're doing that. The Cronins are an example in your book. Tell us about the Cronin family.
Yes. They're a family from the Dubuque, Iowa area. And the father developed Alzheimer's at a very young age and passed away in his early 60s. And the family took the combination of in lieu of flowers donations, which has become much more mm-hmm. popular, I would say, in the past few years, combined it with some of their own funds to have a pool of $15,000. And they put that in an endowment through Loras College, where he had been a professor. And that will go on in perpetuity, kicking mm-hmm. out every year $500 that is then given to his students, selected by a panel of both family members, the Cronin family, as well as faculty at the school, for someone who had been in his department, which was journalism and media. And the family actually will have a picnic every year, as they had when he was teaching. He always had his students over for dinner. And so they've continued that in terms of nurturing and supporting students in his department, having them into the home. And the money, while not a lot, is enough to pay for an interview suit or a ticket to go to an interview, or just pay for car repairs that year for someone who's struggling.
I think many of us can remember those years.
Yes. I think
when $500 as a student would have been a huge, huge benefit.
Right, a huge benefit. And I even think today, if you're a struggling student and you need to have an airline ticket to go interview in New York, and you got it, you know, paid for by the scholarship, it's a great way to promote his legacy of education and journalism. And they did it through $15,000 mm-hmm. because it is part of an endowment at Loras College where he taught.
Well, and it's so nice because it's so closely connected to his life. I mean, I think that's part of it, is that it's kind of taking the best of our lives and continuing after our lives have ended.
Right. And giving them a chance to honor their father. And I also think it gives the family a chance to turn a bit of grief into something positive.
Mm-hmm. Especially, as you said, in a tragic situation where mm-hmm. where a professional life was cut short by Alzheimer's, continuing with the students is really a way to lengthen that.
Correct.
And let's talk about, I think some of the advantages of being philanthropic are quite obvious, but let's kind of go through some of those. One is tax benefits. What kind of benefits are there?
Well, there's taxes for those who are of the higher net worth. If you are concerned about federal estate tax and things like that, you can receive some tax benefits. For the most part in the book, though, I say taxes don't need to be your driving factor. So a lot of people will say, well, I don't have $5.3 million, mm-hmm. which is the current level at which estate tax kicks
in.
$5.3 million. So I don't need to worry about this. And that's why I go in to say there's more reasons beyond that. I would say one side note on the tax issues is, if you want to be philanthropic and you have a retirement account and you'd like to maximize the dollars that go from your retirement account, you could consider naming a nonprofit as part or the entire benefactor of that, because they're exempt from the income tax. Mm-hmm. Whereas opposed to if you leave your IRA to a child, they will be receiving the mandatory distributions, and that stream of revenue is considered earned income from them. And
so
it's taxable. So yes.
And also that's a very, I think also people sometimes think, oh, you know, it's so complicated and you know, it's going to take lots of time and money mm-hmm. and technical knowledge to set these things up. But it's very easy to name a beneficiary on, say, a retirement account.
Correct. Yes, you don't. There's many of these things you can do. You do not even have to talk to an attorney. Now, I always think it's good to either talk to a CPA or an attorney to get a little bit of advice mm-hmm. because the laws are always changing, but it's not a requirement.
I think one of the most obvious things, but it might not come up when we're thinking about leaving a legacy, is it just feels good.
It does.
There's a lot of satisfaction. What are some of the responses you've gotten from clients as you help them decide on a legacy and put it into action?
I would say two. One is a way to process grief. As with the Cronins and other people who have worked with me, they've suffered a loss during their life, and they feel like supporting an organization that was either important in the life of their loved one, or perhaps it's related to research for the disease that took them from them, they might feel more empowered that way. I think for others, sometimes it's just a way to acknowledge that they might have gone through a difficult part of their life, but have now blossomed in a way, whether it be if they've beat a substance abuse issue and they want to name the organization that helped them. It wasn't really from the book or from a client, but my husband's grandmother had always liked to give to the empty stocking fund at the holiday time, because as a child she had been a recipient of that very program, and she wanted to make sure that now that she was, you know, more stable and thriving life, that she gave back. And mm-hmm. I really think it helps people to be grateful and happy And it simply feels good.
And I think also I actually saw a very similar thing with battered women shelters, that often women who either benefited from services or there were not services available when they or their mothers needed them wanted to make sure that those services were there. And I think in a way it's almost it's a way to feel like you've leveled the playing field a little bit, that you're not just the taker anymore, that you're making sure that it's there for someone else.
Correct. You're broadening the path for others. I see a lot of that with people who want to make bequests to a college or a place of higher learning in the field they were in or that they studied.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and Marv in Manitowoc. Hi, Marv.
Hi.
Hi.
I love the saying, more gratitude, less greed. And I think ultimately there's a simple little Buddhist saying that one random act of kindness a day can actually keep an individual healthy and happy. And I don't think necessarily people have to think in terms of being a big philanthropist to become a legacy. I think going from a small philanthropist and doing it every day actually provides more to the giver than it does the receiver. So I think in terms of legacy, the best thing we can do is basically remind ourselves that more gratitude, less greed actually helps our health and helps our longevity and our legacy.
Thanks for that call, Marv. And I'm guessing, Melinda, that you would agree.
Completely.
And I think what Marv brought up is a really good example of those intangibles of leaving a legacy. It's not just necessarily a huge chunk of money, but it's that commitment to the greater good and really trying to leave, as we started out saying, the world a better place than maybe we found it.
I also think it does set a very good example for those who follow us. I mentioned in the book that I'm the parent of young children, and parents with children know when our children mimic our behaviors and things, and often our faces will flush red if we hear words come out of a small child's mouth that we know they heard from us. But even parents who have adult children can do the same thing. If they choose to leave 10% of their retirement account to a nonprofit, or simply say, the furniture that remains in our house when we're gone, please auction that off or have it at a yard sale that benefits a nonprofit. We are demonstrating for our children and providing a good role model for them to follow. And that's just kind of that pay it forward. And my guess is I see a lot of families where one is a giver, many are givers.
Mm-hmm. And when my daughter was young, when she would receive money, whether it was, you know, being paid for doing some chores or something like that, or if it was a gift, she had three envelopes. One was spending, one was saving, and one was giving. And I think it doesn't have to be, you know, an elaborate, like, sit down family meeting kind of thing, but you just kind of introduce those ideas. And then when the children are older, and so are the parents, it's not a completely foreign discussion either.
Correct.
To be talking about a legacy. We are talking with Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She is an attorney and the founder of Gustafson-Gervasi Law Office here in Madison. The practice provides legal services in the area of estate planning and probate, and Melinda is also the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network, and we would like to have you join the conversation. Have you given much thought to what kind of legacy you'd like to leave? Maybe you've taken steps to provide for causes and nonprofit organizations that you care about, or if not, what has held you back? And have you talked with your children and grandchildren about the kind of legacy you'd like to leave? Have you included them in those conversations? We will be back after this look at the news, and we'd love to have you join us. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I hope you'll stay with us. More after this look at the news from NPR. What or who do you think of when you hear the word philanthropist? Certainly high-profile people like Bill and Melinda Gates or Mark Zuckerberg fall into that category, but guess what? So could your neighbor, the store owner who you say hi to when you do your shopping, your child's teacher perhaps, and even you. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're learning how each and every one of us can leave a legacy as we visit with a attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She's the founder of Gustafson-Gervasi Law Office, LLC, located in Madison. The practice provides legal services in the area of estate planning and probate. Wills, powers of attorney, trusts, probate, and the like are the daily focus in the office. And Melinda graduated from the University of Wisconsin Law School. She's the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. And Melinda, thanks again for spending time with us.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's go to the phones first off, and then we will get back to some of the points that you make in the book. And I want to invite our listeners to join in at 1-800-642-1234. First up, we have Joan in Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hello. Just by chance, I had the phone on as I'm on my way to a teacher's luncheon, but I couldn't resist calling in because the joy I have unexpectedly had recently from donating my husband's Robert Frost collection, which was considered the largest private collection in the country. I had the option of selling it and making a lot of money. Instead, I wanted to respect my husband's wishes, which was to put it somewhere where it would be read and studied and used to relate his relationship and friendship with Frost when he was a college student at Dartmouth to nature. I thought that our legacy was going to be leaving our farm out near the Mississippi to the Mississippi Nature Conservancy because he believed that we have to preserve our land, and I agree. But when the opportunity came for me to choose to either sell this large group of first edition books or donate them to a university that promised to use these books and allow students to study Frost and Fritz and the relationship of both of them to preserving our natural resources, I chose donating them to the University of Eau Claire. Hmm. And they are going to have a Robert Frost Day every year on Frost's birthday, which I think is coming up March 25th or 26th, and have this legacy live on, not in money, but in students understanding and respecting our natural resources and the work of my husband and Robert Frost, to see that people understood and worked to preserve our natural resources. So the joy I have, because the acceptance was unbelievable by the people, the students in Eau Claire, who are already allowing students to come from all over the country to study Frost. But I just had to share with others that I'm not rich, but the extra money that I would have received from this at 83 would never, never equal the amount of joy knowing that it's going to be used by many.
Wow. Well, Joan, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Melinda, I can't imagine a better illustration of leaving a legacy and that wonderful feeling that can be enjoyed during life knowing that you've made that.
Exactly. And Joan, thank you for not only setting a great example for all of us, but for sharing it. As I was telling Judith during the break, you know, the end of the year, all the talk of philanthropy was the face of Mark Zuckerberg and all that he had done. And it bothers me because week after week, I have client after client in my office who are either naming organizations in their wills or we're actually doing the probate where these gifts are being recognized. And there are hundreds, thousands of faces and families out there that are philanthropists, just as you are. But we don't get to see that in the news or the media. So, Judith, thank you for giving Joan the spotlight to do that. I think that does also provide a good example. We might not all have first edition Frost books to donate, but if you have lost a loved one, are there artifacts, photographs,
tools. I know in my own family, my mother recently passed, and so I'm going to be looking at boxes of photographs and things that might otherwise sit in my basement. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, can I donate them to a historical society or the museum in the hometown that she's from? So I encourage people to kind of stretch their imagination and say, where might this item be seen by more, help, inspire, share, educate? Mm-hmm. There's lots of historical societies, smaller regional museums that are always looking for new display items and would be happy to give it a new home.
Right. And maybe those photos that you just think of as, oh, this is our family photo, maybe it shows a public space or an event that fits into the history of the community, and other people would like to and enjoy seeing those.
Exactly. You know, it'll have limited exposure in my basement, but endless exposure in a museum or historical center.
Thanks so much for that call, Joan. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. We are talking with attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She's the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Let's go next to Keith in Green Bay. Hi, Keith.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
First, I'd like to commend Joan for her wonderful gift. It's just a wonderful piece of history that she's given us.
Thanks for noting that.
My wife was an elementary teacher for almost 40 years, and 26 of those were up here in Green Bay. She retired last spring, and the next day checked into the hospital for heart surgery, and passed away 12 days later.
I'm sorry for your loss.
I was able to take the money that was given in lieu of flowers and put that with some other funds. And through Scholarships, Inc., there will be a scholarship in her name. We had talked about this for quite a while. But the scholarships, instead of going to freshmen who'll be going off to college, will be going to juniors or seniors who are going to be going in education, because we knew that by the time a student gets to that point in their college career, they've made that commitment to education. But very often the money is drying up. It's mm-hmm. much harder for a junior or senior to find those dollars to continue their education. And that's what she wanted.
And so, Keith, thank you so much for sharing that story, Keith. So Melinda, Keith really put a lot of thought into not just what his wife would have wanted, but also kind of how to have the greatest and deepest impact with the gift as well.
Correct. And I think that's one of the things that comes along with giving this uncomfortable topic some thought beforehand. Well, I do a lot of seminars around town, and one of the things I always say is, you know, illness, death, and taxes are not something we all want to think about, but you can motivate yourself by meditating on the word control, mm-hmm. by thinking about this, by having the conversation that Keith had with his wife. They were taking control of the situation. They knew they wanted to do something. And if you can give a little bit of thought in advance, or sometimes we don't even have to do things too quickly after a person is gone, you can really isolate and zero in on a program or organization where your money can have great leverage, either starting a new initiative or push something over the top, or as he pointed out, I think quite truly that, you know, it's the juniors and seniors who are going to be tapped out, and that's a wonderful, wonderful way to promote education.
So there are several steps, I think. There's deciding to leave a legacy that you want to, you know, have that lasting impact on the world. Then there's deciding what the issues or topics might be. And then kind of figuring out within those topics, so what is, you know, not just, oh, here's an education scholarship, but let's look at the students who are far enough in their studies that they're pretty sure what they're going to do and might not have other resources. But then there's also the vehicle. And so one of the things that you talk about in Middle Class Philanthropist is, you know, choosing the organizations that will be able to how can I put it, who will most closely be able to match what your wishes are with the work that they're doing. And you actually say to look at grassroots groups because there's a lot of impact there. Why is that?
Well, I wouldn't say just to look at grassroots.
Not just, but a lot of people, I think, think of the larger organizations first.
Mm-hmm. I think they do. Grassroots often tend to be in your own backyard. They might be something that you can actually have some one-on-one exposure to. Maybe you're volunteering with them. Also, if you really want to have the most bang for your buck, to so to speak, sometimes with an organization that's so small, they don't have a very large operating budget, and it doesn't take much for them to all of a sudden receive what's the equivalent of 3 years of fundraising. There are two different stories in the book. One is about the Soy Machine Project, which is local here in Monona, and they gather up soy machines and redistribute them around the world and put them in the hands of people who will become seamstresses, and particularly focused on areas that have been devastated by typhoons or hurricanes. And they all of a sudden started receiving checks in the mail that were in the memory of a woman named Viola. And they had never heard of Viola before. And they did some internet searching, thanks to Google, and discovered obituary from a woman who was in northern Minnesota named Viola Kramer, who had passed away. And Viola's family knew that she loved sewing. It was a passion of hers. And they did some research and had found the Sewing Machine Project. She had never been associated with it during her life, but they knew it mirrored her passion. Mm-hmm. And they assumed that because it was a small organization that they would welcome some of those funds. And so I believe it was something like a 10% bump in its annual budget just from her obituary and the in lieu of flowers, please send checks to the Sewing Machine Project. And then there's another story in the book of a woman named Gail Sheffield, who upon her death left a modest ranch type house to one organization where she had volunteered with feral cats. And then she left about $100,000, sort of, that was liquid retirement type funds, to another feral cat organization. One was in Montana, the other in Louisiana. Both of those gifts, which if you're thinking about it, it's not the wealth of Mark Zuckerberg or the Gates family, but it was 3 years equivalent of fundraising dollars for those organizations. It gave them the ability to do things they'd never been able to do. And as they say in the book, one of them, it was a huge thank you for seemingly tireless and thankless work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you can look to an organization like that. I would add one thing, and I talk about this in the book too, is do a little bit of research on the organization that you pick. One, nonprofits, unfortunately, are not free of fraud. There are organizations out there that are fraudulent, that are set up to look very similar to the larger organizations that we all know and love, but they are not indeed that organization. There has been some issues of embezzlement from organizations, so you might think their leadership might not be where I want that to go, at least not right now. And also to make sure that you have the correct legal name. I've seen this a lot where people think they know the name of an organization and it's not that name. And lawyers are trained to be very precise. We can annoy people in that regard many ways.
It's very useful, though.
It is useful, especially in this area, because you want to be precise. There's a mention in the book about a gentleman who left a bequest to the Alzheimer Research Center. When he died, no such organization existed. Three different organizations stepped forward and said he meant us. Two he'd had dealings with during his life, and the third simply had all of those words in its name. And so the court said, what we're going to do is divide it between the three of you, which is not what the intentions of that gentleman were. So I always advise people to make sure you know the complete and full legal name of the entity, which often means looking at their website or sending in an email to fundraiser.
Or going to GuideStar.org.
GuideStar, Charity Navigator.
Yep.
And also, I think the gold standard is to include their tax ID number. Because then we know, are we talking about a regional versus a national branch of an organization? So it's very important to be very, very specific once you've got that nonprofit or more. You can have more than one nonprofit in your eyes in terms
but
of what
to make sure that what your intention is
exactly
is easy to follow.
Yes.
And actually, Ray and Stephen's point has a question about how to choose the right organization. So let's go there. Hi, Ray.
Well, you just talked about it, but I was wondering if you had more suggestions on how one might research a charity or organization to make sure that we're not giving to someone who's not really spending much of the money for what they suggest that they do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Ray, I think that's a good question. And in the notes that I see, I do see something that is noted here with you'd want to avoid organizations with high administrative costs. And I would actually like to expand on that a little bit. And it was a nonprofit that actually brought this to my attention, and I agree with them. Sometimes a nonprofit is going to have high administrative costs, and that is because they may only have two staff people, but the bulk and majority of the work is done by volunteers. So you don't want to just write off an organization immediately because it has high administrative costs. The book has an entire page of various websites that you can go to, but Charity Navigator is one. The Better Business Bureau is another. They will evaluate nonprofit organizations. The IRS does things. The Attorney General's Office of each state often maintains a list of fraudulent activities by nonprofit or entities that pretend that they're nonprofits, and so that would be another thing as well. Mm-hmm. So Better Business Bureau, Charity Navigator, IRS.
And I think also, Ray, that's a great question. Thanks for calling, Melinda. One of the things that you were just kind of getting at is that it really depends on the kind of organization, too, because if it's an organization that is working directly for and with clients, they are likely going to be spending maybe less on their people and more on the programs, whereas another organization that's maybe about advocacy is going to have a lot higher, it's going to look like a lot higher costs of just doing business because that's the main thing that they're doing.
Right. And if it's possible, I'd recommend to go there. See it right in person. Is it a place that you can volunteer at? Do they have an annual report that you can review or some sort of annual meeting that you can attend? If you're going to be leaving something to them and you want it to be a significant legacy and used well, dig in as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She's the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. And we do have time for another call or two if you'd like to join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melinda, you have a list of really great, easy ways to put giving in action at the end of people's lives. We talked about the in lieu of flowers in the obituary. You also talked about that in a will, you can say that you'd like your household furnishings sold at maybe an estate sale that benefits a particular charity. And we had such a wonderful example from Joan in Milwaukee talking about, you know, donating a valuable item instead of selling it or leaving it to an heir, you know, leaving that amazing collection of literature where it can be used and enjoyed by scholars and the public alike. What other things can we do that don't involve, you know, huge legal documents? You talked about retirement funds, but what about like a checking or a savings mm-hmm. account that we might have?
I think all of those, this is where we get into the area of beneficiary forms. And this is something that you can do on your own. And it's essentially a label that you would put on an asset that says, when I die, all or a percentage of this should go to. And this is where you could name a charity, you could name family or whatever you wanted. But we call them non-direct transfers. They transfer outside of probate.
So it's much faster, too.
It is much faster, and you avoid probate fees. You know, here in Wisconsin, our probate fee is relatively small. It's 0.2%. Other states can be as high as 8 or 10%.
So, really?
Yeah, there is
8 or 10%?
I believe it's like Florida and Illinois. And
wow.
So that's an important thing to know. But if you know, whatever, if you wanted to go much faster, to look at the types of assets where you can put a beneficiary form on them. So, for example, retirement accounts. That would be filled out. You can also do life insurance policies. Some people currently carry those. You could leave a percentage or an entire policy to the entity you'd wanted. Some people, if they're in good health and they're still insurable, might say, you know, I'd like to leave a sizable amount to my nonprofit, but I don't want to do it now, but I could afford a monthly premium. And so they take out a policy with the nonprofit named as the beneficiary, and they pay that monthly premium. Other things would be...
So it's kind of like making, you know, a lot of organizations have sustaining members who make a monthly gift. This way, it's the equivalent of making a monthly gift, but for a payoff down the
right,
road.
Right. And for some people, it's just not the right fit because they might not be the, you know, largest consumer of an insurance product. But other things to consider would be, you know, like you just said, your savings or checking, whether it's at the bank or the credit union, you can put on there what we call a POD, which stands for pay on death. And it's essentially a label. And it says, when I die, this asset shall pass to so-and-so. So if you have a travel account that you know, you use, and if when your time comes, there's a $5,000
their unused balance. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want that to go out to your, you know, place of worship or your college alumni fund, mm-hmm. or Wisconsin Public Radio, or anything like that. You could just say, it was left over. I didn't need it.
I had it in case. Kind of like a rainy day. Like, if I needed it, it was there, but once you pass away, you don't need it.
Yep. So bank accounts and credit unions are good places. We call those PODs. If you have brokerage accounts, they call those TODs, transfer on death. And so those are all ways in which you can go and name them. I would just say, you know, use caution if you're doing that on your own, because you want to make sure you're getting the name of the nonprofit correct, as we had just discussed. Mm-hmm. I would also advise that you keep a copy of that beneficiary form. This always drives my husband nuts. He's an electronics engineer, and all things digital or sacred to him. But in my world, paper still matters. And I say this because institutions can and do lose records of beneficiary forms. So you want to have a hard copy in your paperwork that shows that, in fact, you did have this beneficiary form in place naming your favorite nonprofit. It's a guide to those who you leave behind about where your asset was held, mm-hmm. because they're not going to necessarily know you've passed, right. and will just sit on the asset. And then if it were lost by the entity, it would be proof that, in fact, it should go out to the nonprofit. Because if you wanted it to go to a nonprofit as opposed to, say, heirs under statute, and the form were lost, most likely the heirs under statute would receive it, and it wouldn't be your intention. Mm.
Well, so much to talk about, but we're out of time. So I will point people to Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi's book, Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. Melinda, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And you can find that on the web, or we have a link on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And I will tell you that tomorrow at 11, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be here, and she is going to tell us how to pet-proof our home. So I think we think of child-proofing a lot, but pet-proofing is just as important. So I hope you'll tune in tomorrow for that, and I hope you'll stay tuned. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks to Marika Suval for on-air production today. Stay tuned.